I'm not a bad swimmer when people aren't pelting me with rocks, but my first shore-to-float-to-shore lap was tentative and unrhythmic, ugly, because I kept expecting something to reach up from the bottom and grab me. The drowned boy, maybe. The second lap was better, and by the third I was relishing the increased kick of my heart and the silky coolness of the water rushing past me. Halfway through the fourth lap, I pulled myself up the float's ladder and collapsed on the boards, feeling better than I had since my encounter with DeVore and Roget Whitmore on Friday night. I was still in the zone, and on top of that, I was experiencing a glorious endorphin rush. In that state, even the dismay I'd felt when Mrs. M. told me she was resigning her position ebbed away. She would come back when this was over. Of course she would. In the meantime, it was probably best she stay away. Something's mad at me. I could have an accident. Yes, indeed. She might cut herself. She might fall down a flight of cellar stairs. She might even have a stroke running across a hot parking lot. I sat up and looked at Sarah on her hill, the deck jutting out over the drop, the railroad ties descending. I'd only been out of the water for a few minutes, but already the day's sticky heat was folding over me, stealing my rush. The water was still as a mirror. I could see the house reflected in it, and in the reflection, Sarah's windows became watchful eyes. I thought that the focus of all the phenomena, the epicenter, was very likely on the street between the real Sarah and its drowned image. This is where it happened, DeVore had said. And the old-timers? Most of them probably knew what I did, that Royce Merrill had been murdered. And wasn't it possible, wasn't it likely, that what had killed him might come among them as they sat in their pews or gathered afterward around his grave? That it might steal some of their force, their guilt, their memories, their TR-ness, to help it finish the job? I was very glad that John was going to be at the trailer tomorrow, and Romeo Bissonette, and George Kennedy, who was so amusing when he got a drink or two in him. Glad it was going to be more than just me with Maddie and Kai when the old folks got together to give Royce Merrill his send-off. I no longer cared very much about what had happened to Sarah and the Red Tops, or even about what was haunting my house. What I wanted was to get through tomorrow, and for Maddie and Kai to get through tomorrow. We'd eat before the rain started, and then let the predicted thunderstorms come. I thought that, if we could ride them out, our lives and futures might clarify with the weather. "Is that right?" I asked. I expected no answer. Talking out loud was a habit I had picked up since returning here. But somewhere in the woods east of the house, an owl hooted. Just once, as if to say it was right. Get through tomorrow and things will clarify. The hoot almost brought something else to mind, some association that was ultimately too gauzy to grasp. I tried once or twice, but the only thing I could come up with was the title of a wonderful old novel, I Heard the Owl Call My Name. I rolled forward off the float and into the water, grasping my knees against my chest like a kid doing a cannonball. I stayed under as long as I could, until the air in my lungs started to feel like some hot bottled liquid, and then I broke the surface. I trod water about 30 yards out until I had my breath back, then set my sights on the Green Lady and stroked for shore. I waded out, started up the railroad ties, then stopped and went back to the street. I stood there for a moment, gathering my courage, then walked to where the birch curved her graceful belly out over the water. I grasped that white curve as I had on Friday evening and looked into the water. I was sure I'd see the child, his dead eyes looking up at me from his bloating brown face, and that my mouth and throat would once more fill up with the taste of the lake. Help me, I'm drowned. Let me up. Oh, sweet Jesus, let me up. But there was nothing. No dead boy, no ribbon-wrapped Boston Post cane, no taste of the lake in my mouth. I turned and peered at the gray forehead of rock poking out of the mulch. I thought, there, right there. But it was only a conscious and unspontaneous thought, the mind voicing a memory. The smell of decay and the certainty that something awful had happened right there was gone. When I got back up to the house and went for a soda, I discovered the front of the refrigerator was bare and clean. Every magnetic letter, every fruit and vegetable was gone. I never found them. I might have, probably would have, if there had been more time. But on that Monday morning, time was almost up. I dressed, then called Maddie. We talked about the upcoming party, about how excited Kai was, about how nervous Maddie was about going back to work on Friday. She was afraid that the locals would be mean to her, but in an odd, womanly way, she was even more afraid that they would be cold to her, snub her. We talked about the money, and I quickly ascertained that she didn't believe in the reality of it. Lance used to say his father was the kind of man who'd show a piece of meat to a starving dog and then eat it himself, she said. But as long as I have my job back, I won't starve, and neither will Kai. But if there really are big bucks? Oh, gimme, 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 she said, laughing. What do you think I am, crazy? Nah. By the way, what's going on with Kai's frigifator people? Are they writing any new stuff? That is the weirdest thing, she said. They're gone. The frigifator people? I don't know about them, but the magnetic letters you gave her sure are. When I asked Kai what she did with them, she started crying and said Alamaguzalem took them. She said he ate them in the middle of the night while everyone was sleeping for a snack. Alamaguzalem? Alamaguzalem, Maddie said, sounding wearily amused. Another little legacy from her grandfather. It's a corruption of the Micmac word for boogeyman, or demon. I looked it up at the library. Kyra had a good many nightmares about demons and wendigos in the Alamaguzalem late last winter and this spring. What a sweet old grandpa he was, I said sentimentally. Yeah, right, a real pip. She was miserable over losing the letters. I barely got her calmed down before her ride to VBS came. Kai wants to know if you'll come to final exercises on Friday afternoon, by the way. She and her friend Billy Turgeon are going to flannel board the story of Baby Moses. I wouldn't miss it, I said. But of course I did. We all did. Any idea where her letters might have gone, Mike? No. Yours are still okay. Mine are fine, but of course mine don't spell anything, I said, looking at the empty door of my own frigifator. There was sweat on my forehead. I could feel it creeping down into my eyebrows like oil. Did you, I don't know, sense anything? You mean, did I maybe hear the evil alphabet thief as he slid through the window? You know what I mean. I suppose so. A pause. I thought I heard something in the night, okay? About 3 this morning, actually. I got up and went into the hall. Nothing was there, but you know how hot it's been lately? Yes. Well, not in my trailer, not last night. It was cold as ice. I swear I could almost see my breath. I believed her. After all, I had seen mine. Were the letters on the front of the fridge then? I don't know. I didn't go up the hall far enough to see into the kitchen. I took one look around and then went back to bed. I almost ran back to bed. Sometimes bed feels safer, you know? She laughed nervously. It's a kid thing. Covers are boogeyman kryptonite. Only at first, when I got in, I don't know, I thought someone was in there already, like someone had been hiding on the floor underneath, and then, when I went to check the hall, they got in. Not a very nice someone, either. Give me my dust catcher, I thought, and shuddered. What? Maddie asked sharply. What did you say? I asked, who did you think it was? What was the first name that came into your mind? DeVore, she said. Him. But there was no one there. A pause. I wish you'd been there. I do, too. I'm glad. Mike, do you have any ideas at all about this? Because it's very freaky. I think maybe for a moment I was on the verge of telling her what had happened to my own letters. But if I started talking, where would it stop? And how much could she be expected to believe? Maybe Kai took the letters herself, went walking in her sleep and chucked them under the trailer or something. Do you think that could be? I think I like the idea of Kai strolling around in her sleep even less than the idea of ghosts with cold breath taking the letters off the fridge, Maddie said. Take her to bed with you tonight, I said, and felt her thought come back like an arrow. I'd rather take you. What she said, after a brief pause, was, Will you come by today? I don't think so, I said. She was noshing on flavored yogurt as we talked, eating it in little nipping bites. You'll see me tomorrow, though, at the party. I hope we get to eat before the thunderstorms. They're supposed to be bad. I'm sure we will. And are you still thinking? I only ask because I dreamed of you when I finally fell asleep again. I dreamed of you kissing me. I'm still thinking, I said, thinking hard. But in fact, I don't remember thinking about anything very hard that day. What I remember was drifting further and further into that zone I've explained so badly. Near dusk, I went for a long walk in spite of the heat, all the way out to where Lane 42 joins the highway. Coming back, I stopped on the edge of Tidwell's Meadow, watching the light fade out of the sky and listening to thunder rumble somewhere over New Hampshire. Once more, there was that sense of how thin reality was, not just here, but everywhere. How it was stretched like skin over the blood and tissue of a body we can never know clearly in this life. I looked at trees and saw arms. I looked at bushes and saw faces. Ghosts, Maddie had said. Ghosts with cold breath. Time was also thin, it seemed to me. Kyra and I had really been at the Freiburg Fair, some version of it anyway. We had really visited the year 1900. And at the foot of the meadow, the red tops were almost there now, as they once had been, in their neat little cabins. I could almost hear the sound of their guitars, the murmur of their voices and laughter. I could almost see the gleam of their lanterns and smell their beef and pork frying. Say, baby, do you remember me? One of her songs went. Well, I ain't your honey like I used to be. Something rattled in the underbrush to my left. I turned that way, expecting to see Sarah step out of the woods wearing Maddie's dress and Maddie's white sneakers. In this gloom, they would seem almost to float by themselves until she got close to me. There was no one there, of course. It had undoubtedly been nothing but Chuck the Woodchuck, headed home after a hard day at the office. But I no longer wanted to be out here, watching as the light drained out of the day and the mist came up from the ground. I turned for home. Instead of going into the house when I got back, I made my way along the path to Joe's studio, where I hadn't been since the night I had taken my IBM back in a dream. My way was lit by intermittent flashes of heat lightning. The studio was hot but not stale. I could smell a peppery aroma that was actually pleasant, and wondered if it might be some of Joe's herbs. There was an air conditioner out here, and it worked. I turned it on and then just stood in front of it a little while. So much cold air on my overheated body was probably unhealthy, but it felt wonderful. I didn't feel very wonderful otherwise, however. I looked around with a growing sense of something too heavy to be mere sadness. It felt like despair. I think it was caused by the contrast between how little of Joe was left in Sarah Laughs and how much of her was still out here. I imagined our marriage as a kind of playhouse, and isn't that what marriage is in large part, playing house? Where only half the stuff was held down by little magnets or hidden cables. Something had come along and picked up our playhouse by one corner, easiest thing in the world, and I supposed I should be grateful that the something hadn't decided to draw back its foot and kick the poor thing all the way over. It just picked up that one corner, you see? My stuff stayed put, but all Joe's had slid out of the house and down here. Joe? I asked, and sat down in her chair. There was no answer. No thumps on the wall. No crows or owls calling from the woods. I put my hand on her little desk where the typewriter had been and slipped my hand across it, picking up a film of dust. "I miss you, honey," I said, and began to cry. When the tears were over, again, I wiped my face with the tail of my T-shirt like a little kid, then just looked around. There was the picture of Sarah Tidwell on one wall, and a photo I didn't remember on another. This latter was old, sepia-tinted, and woodsy. Its focal point was a man-high birchwood cross in a little clearing on a slope above the lake. That clearing was gone from the geography now, most likely, long since filled in by trees. I looked at her jars of herbs and mushroom sections, her filing cabinets, her sections of Afghan, the green rag rug on the floor, the pots of pencils on the desk, pencils she had touched and used. I held one of them poised over a blank sheet of paper for a moment or two, but nothing happened. I had a sense of life in this room, and a sense of being watched, but not a sense of being helped. "I know some of it, but not enough," I said. "Of all the things I don't know, maybe the one that matters most is who wrote 'Help her' on the fridge. Was it you, Joe?" No answer. I sat a while longer, hoping against hope, I suppose, then got up, turned off the air conditioning, turned off the lights, and went back to the house, walking in soft, bright stutters of unfocused lightning. I sat on the deck for a little while, watching the night. At some point, I realized I'd taken the length of blue silk ribbon out of my pocket and was winding it nervously back and forth between my fingers, making half-assed cat's cradles. Had it really come from the year 1900? The idea seemed perfectly crazy and perfectly sane at the same time. The night hung hot and hushed. I imagined old folks all over the TR, perhaps in Motton and Harlow, too, laying out their funeral clothes for tomorrow. In the double-wide trailer on Wasp Hill Road, Kai was sitting on the floor watching a videotape of The Jungle Book. Baloo and Mowgli were singing The Bare Necessities. Maddie was on the couch with her feet up, reading the new Mary Higgins Clark and singing along. Both were wearing shorty pajamas, Kai's pink, Maddie's white. After a little while, I lost my sense of them. It faded the way radio signals do late at night. I went into the north bedroom, undressed, and crawled onto the top sheet of my unmade bed. I fell asleep almost at once. I woke in the middle of the night with someone running a hot finger up and down the middle of my back. I rolled over, and when the lightning flashed, I saw there was a woman in bed with me. It was Sarah Tidwell. She was grinning. There were no pupils in her eyes. "Oh, sugar, I'm almost back," she whispered in the dark. I had a sense of her reaching out for me again. But when the next flash of lightning came, that side of the bed was empty. Inspiration isn't always a matter of ghosts moving magnets around on refrigerator doors. And on Tuesday morning, I had a flash that was a beaut. It came while I was shaving and thinking about nothing more than remembering the beer for the party. And like the best inspirations, it came out of nowhere at all. I hurried into the living room, not quite running, wiping the shaving cream off my face with a towel as I went. I glanced briefly at the Tough Stuff crossword collection lying on top of my manuscript. That had been where I'd gone first, in an effort to decipher Go Down 19 and Go Down 92. Not an unreasonable starting point, but what did Tough Stuff have to do with TR 90? I'd purchased the book at Mr. Paperback in Derry, and of the 30 or so puzzles I'd completed, I'd done all but half a dozen in Derry. TR ghosts could hardly be expected to show an interest in my Derry crossword collection. The telephone book, on the other hand. I snatched it off the dining room table. Although it covered the whole southern part of Castle County, Motton, Harlow, and Cashwackamack, as well as the TR, it was pretty thin. The first thing I did was check the white pages to see if there were at least 92. There were. the Y's and Z's finished up on page 97. This was the answer. Had to be. I got it, didn't I? I asked Bunter. This is it. Nothing. Not even a tinkle from the bell. Fuck you. What does a stuffed moose head know about a telephone book? Go down 19. I turned to page 19 of the telephone book, where the letter F was prominently showcased. I began to slip my finger down the first column, and as it went, my excitement faded. The 19th name on page 19 was Harold Fales. It meant nothing to me. There were also Feltons and Fenners, a Filkersham and several Finneys, half a dozen Flahertys and more Fosses than you could shake a stick at. The last name on page 19 was Framingham. It also meant nothing to me, but... Framingham. Kenneth P. I stared at that for a moment. A realization began to dawn. It had nothing to do with refrigerator messages. You're not seeing what you think you're seeing, I thought. This is like when you buy a blue Buick. You see blue Buicks everywhere, I said. Practically got to kick them out of your way. Yeah, that's it. But my hands were shaking as I turned to page 92. Here were the T's of Southern Castle County, along with a few U's like Alton Ubeck and Catherine Udell, just to round things out. I didn't bother checking the 92nd entry on the page. The phone book wasn't the key to the magnetic cross patches after all. It did, however, suggest something enormous. I closed the book, just held it in my hands for a moment, happy folks with blueberry rakes on the front cover, then opened it at random, this time to the M's. And once you knew what you were looking for, it jumped right out at you. All those K's. Oh, there were Stevens and Johns and Marthas. There was a Meserve G and a Messier V and J House T. And yet, again and again, I saw the initial K where people had exercised their right not to list their first name in the book. There were at least 20 K initials on page 50 alone, and another dozen C initials. As for the actual names themselves... There were 12 Kenneths on this random page in the M section, including 3 Kenneth Moores and 2 Kenneth Munters. There were 4 Catherines with the C and 2 Catherines with the K. There was a Casey, a Kiana, and a Kiefer. Holy Christ, it's like fallout, I whispered. I thumbed through the book, not able to believe what I was seeing and seeing it anyway. Kenneths, Catherines, and Keiths were everywhere. I also saw Kimberly, Kim with an I, and Kim with a Y. There was Cammy, Kaya, yes, and we had thought ourselves so original, Kaya with an H, Kendra, Kayla, Kyle, K-E-I-L, and Kyle, K-Y-L-E. There was Kirby and Kirk. There was a woman named Kissy Bowden and a man named Keto Rennie. Keto, the same name as one of Kyra's frigifator people. And everywhere, outnumbering such usually common initials as S and T and E, were those K's. My eyes danced with them. I turned to look at the clock. Didn't want to stand John Starrow up at the airport. Christ, no. And there was no clock there. Of course not. Old Crazy Cat had popped his peepers during a psychic event and was now residing in the trash. I gave a loud, braying laugh that scared me a little. It wasn't particularly sane. Get hold of yourself, Mike, I said. Take a deep breath, son. I took a breath, held it, let it out, checked the digital readout on the microwave. 8:15. Plenty of time for John. I turned back to the telephone book and began to riffle rapidly through it. I'd had a second inspiration, not a megawatt blast like the first one, but a lot more accurate, it turned out. Western Maine is a relatively isolated area. It's a little like the hill country of the border south, but there has always been at least some inflow of folks from away. Flatlanders is the term the locals use when they are feeling contemptuous. and in the last quarter of the century, it has become a popular area for active seniors who want to fish and ski their way through retirement. The phone book goes a long way towards separating the newbies from the longtime residents. Babickies, Paredes, O'Quinlans, Donahues, Smallnacks, Dvoraks, Blindermeyers, all from away. All Flatlanders. Jalberts, Meserves, Pillsburys, Spruces, Terrios, Perots, Stanchfields, Starbirds, Dubays, all from Castle County. You see what I'm saying, don't you? When you see a whole column of Bowies on page 12, you know that those folks have been around long enough to relax and really spread those Bowie genes. There were a few K initials and K names among the Paredes and the Smallnacks, but only a few. The heavy concentrations were all attached to families that had been here long enough to absorb the atmosphere, to breathe the fallout. Except it wasn't radiation exactly, yet I suddenly imagined a black headstone, taller than the tallest tree on the lake, a monolith which cast its shadow over half of Castle County. This picture was so clear and so terrible that I covered my eyes, dropping the phone book on the table. I backed away from it, shuddering. Hiding my eyes actually seemed to enhance the image further, a grave marker so enormous it blotted out the sun. TR-90 lay at its foot like a funeral bouquet or a ceremonial slain dove. Sarah Tidwell's son had drowned in Darkscore Lake, or been drowned in it, but she had marked his passing, memorialized it. I wondered if anyone else in town had ever noticed what I just had. I didn't suppose it was all that likely. When you open a telephone book, you're looking for a specific name in most cases, not reading whole pages line by line. I wondered if Joe had noticed, if she'd known that almost every longtime family in this part of the world had, in one way or another, named at least one child after Sarah Tidwell's dead son. Joe wasn't stupid. I thought she probably had. I returned to the bathroom, relathered, started again from scratch. When I finished, I went back to the phone and picked it up. I poked in three numbers, then stopped, looking out at the lake. Maddie and Kai were up and in the kitchen, both of them wearing aprons, both of them in a fine froth of excitement. There was going to be a party. They would wear pretty new summer clothes, and there would be music from Maddie's boombox CD player. Kai was helping Maddie make biscuits for strawberry snort cake, and while they were baking, mother and daughter would make salads. If I called Maddie up and said, "Pack a couple of bags, you and Kai are going to spend a week at Disney World," Maddie would assume I was joking, then tell me to hurry up and finish getting dressed so I'd be at the airport when John's plane landed. If I pressed, she'd remind me that Lindy had offered her old job back, but the offer would close in a hurry if Maddie didn't show up promptly at 2 p.m. on Friday. If I continued to press, she would just say no, because I wasn't the only one in the zone, was I? I wasn't the only one who was really feeling it. I returned the phone to its recharging cradle, then went back into the north bedroom. By the time I'd finished dressing, my fresh shirt was already feeling wilted under the arms. It was as hot that morning as it had been for the last week, maybe even hotter. But I'd be in plenty of time to meet the plane. I had never felt less like partying, but I'd be there. Mikey on the spot, that was me. Mikey on the goddamn spot. John hadn't given me his flight number, but at Castle County Airport, such niceties are hardly necessary. This bustling hub of transport consists of three hangars and a terminal which used to be a Flying A gas station. When the light's strong on the little building's rusty north side, you can still see the shape of that winged A. There's one runway. Security is provided by Lassie, Breck Pellerin's ancient colleague, who spends her days crashed out on the linoleum floor, cocking an ear at the ceiling whenever a plane lands or takes off. I popped my head into Pellerin's office and asked him if the 10 from Boston was on time. He said 'twas, although he hoped the party I was meeting planned to either fly back out before mid-afternoon or stay the night. Bad weather was coming in, good gory, yes. What Brick Pellerin referred to as electrical weather. I knew exactly what he meant, because in my nervous system, that electricity already seemed to have arrived. I went out to the runway side of the terminal and sat on a bench advertising Cormier's Market. Fly into our deli for the best meats in Maine. The sun was a silver button stuck on the eastern slope of a hot white sky. Headache weather, my mother would have called it, but the weather was due to change. I would hold on to the hope of that change as best I could. At 10 past 10, I heard a wasp whine from the south. At 10:15, some sort of twin-engine plane dropped out of the murk, flopped onto the runway, and taxied toward the terminal. There were only 4 passengers, and John Starrow was the first one off. I grinned when I saw him. I had to grin. He was wearing a black T-shirt with "We Are the Champions" printed across the front, and a pair of khaki shorts which displayed a perfect set of city shins, white and bony. He was trying to manage both a styrofoam cooler and a briefcase. I grabbed the cooler maybe 4 seconds before he could drop it and tucked it under my arm. "Mike," he cried, lifting one hand palm out. "John," I returned in much the same spirit. Evaway is the word that comes immediately to the crossword aficionado's mind, and slapped him 5. His homely, handsome face split in a grin, and I felt a little stab of guilt. Maddie had expressed no preference for John, quite the opposite, in fact, and he really hadn't solved any of her problems. DeVore had done that by topping himself before John had so much as a chance to get started on her behalf. Yet still I felt that nasty little poke. "Come on," he said. "Let's get out of this heat. You have air conditioning in your car, I presume?" "Absolutely." "What about a cassette player? You got one of those? If you do, I'll play you something that'll make you chortle." "I don't think I've ever heard that word actually used in conversation, John." The grin shone out again, and I noticed what a lot of freckles he had. Sheriff Andy's boy, Opie, grows up to serve at the bar. "I'm a lawyer. I use words in conversation that haven't even been invented yet. You have a tape player?" "Of course I do." I hefted the cooler. "Steaks?" "You bet. Peter Luger's. They're the best in the world. You told me." As we went into the terminal, someone said, "Michael?" It was Romeo Bissonette, the lawyer who had chaperoned me through my deposition. In one hand, he had a box wrapped in red paper and tied with a white ribbon. Beside him, just rising from one of the lumpy chairs, was a tall guy with a fringe of gray hair. He was wearing a brown suit, a blue shirt, and a string tie with a golf club on the clasp. He looked more like a farmer on auction day than the sort of guy who'd be a scream when you got a drink or two into him, but I had no doubt this was the private detective. He stepped over the comatose collie and shook hands with me. "George Kennedy, Mr. Noonan. I'm pleased to meet you. My wife has read every single book you ever wrote." "Well, thank her for me." "I will. I have one in the car. A hardcover." He looked shy, as so many people do when they get right to the point of asking. "I wonder if you'd sign it for her at some point." "I'd be delighted to," I said. "Right away's best, then I won't forget." I turned to Romeo. "Good to see you, Romeo." "Make it Rami," he said. "Good to see you, too." He held out the box. "George and I clubbed together on this. We thought you deserved something nice for helping a damsel in distress." Kennedy now didn't look like a man who might be fun after a few drinks, the kind who might just take a notion to hop onto the nearest table, turn a tablecloth into a kilt, and dance. I looked at John, who gave the kind of shrug that means, "Hey, don't ask me." I pulled off the satin bow, slipped my finger under the scotch tape holding the paper, then looked up. I caught Rami Bissonette in the act of elbowing Kennedy. Now they were both grinning. "There's nothing in here that's going to jump out at me and go booga booga, is there, guys?" I asked. "Absolutely not," Rami said, but his grin widened. "Well, I can be as good a sport as the next guy, I guess." I unwrapped the package, opened the plain white box inside, revealed a square pad of cotton, lifted it out. I had been smiling all through this, but now I felt the smile curl up and die on my mouth. Something went twisting up my spine as well, and I think I came very close to dropping the box. It was the oxygen mask DeVore had had on his lap when he met me on the street, the one he'd snorted from occasionally as he and Roguette paced me, trying to keep me out deep enough to drown. Rami Bissonette and George Kennedy had brought it to me like the scalp of a dead enemy, and I was supposed to think it was funny. "Mike?" Rami asked anxiously. "Mike, are you okay? It was just a joke." I blinked and saw it wasn't an oxygen mask at all. How in God's name could I have been so stupid? For one thing, it was bigger than DeVore's mask. For another, it was made of opaque rather than clear plastic. It was... I gave a tentative chuckle. Rami Bissonette looked tremendously relieved. So did Kennedy. John only looked puzzled. "Funny," I said, "like a rubber crutch." I pulled out the little mic from inside the mask and let it dangle. It swung back and forth on its wire, reminding me of the waggy clock's tail. "What the hell is it?" John asked.
"Park Avenue lawyer,"
Rami said to George, broadening his accent so it came out. "Park Avenue lawyer.
Ain't never seen one of those, have you, chummy? No, sir, cost not."
Then he reverted to normal speak, which was sort of a relief. I've lived in Maine my whole life, and for me the amusement value of burlesque Yankee accents has worn pretty thin. "It's a steno mask. The stenog keeping the record at Mike's depot was wearing one. Mike kept looking at him." "It freaked me out," I said. "Old guy sitting in the corner and mumbling into the mask of Zorro." "Jerry Bliss freaks a lot of people out," Kennedy said. He spoke in a low rumble. "He's the last one around here who wears them. He's got 10 or 11 left in his mudroom. I know, because I bought that one from him." "I hope he stuck it to you," I said.
"I thought it would make a nice memento," Rami said. "But for a second there, I thought I'd given you the box with the severed hand in it. I hate it when I mix up my gift boxes like that. What's the deal?"
"It's been a long, hot July," I said. "Put it down to that." I hung the steno mask strap over one finger, dangling it that way. "Maddie said to be there by 11, John told us. "We're going to drink beer and throw the frisbee around."
"I can do both those things quite well," George Kennedy said.
Outside in the tiny parking lot, George went to a dusty Altima, rummaged in the back, and came out with a battered copy of The Red Shirt Man. "Frida made me bring this one. She has the newer ones, but this is her favorite. Sorry about how it looks. She read it about 6 times. "It's my favorite, too," I said, which was true, "and I like to see a book with mileage." That was also true. I opened the book, looked approvingly at a smear of long-dried chocolate on the flyleaf, and then wrote, "For Frida Kennedy, whose husband was there to lend a hand. Thanks for sharing him, and thanks for reading. Mike Noonan." That was a long inscription for me. Usually I just stick to best wishes or good luck, but I wanted to make up for the curdled expression they had seen on my face when I opened their innocent little gag present. While I was scribbling, George asked me if I was working on a new novel. "No," I said. "Battery's currently on recharge." I handed the book back. "Frida won't like that." "No, but there's always Red Shirt." "We'll follow you," Rami said, and a rumble came from deep in the west. It was no louder than the thunder which had rumbled on and off for the last week, but this wasn't dry thunder. We all knew it, and we all looked in that direction. "Think we'll get a chance to eat before it storms?" George asked me. "Yeah, just about barely,"